This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. This morning, Canadian police brought 12 suspected terrorists into a Toronto courtroom for bail hearings. These men, along with five teenagers, were arrested Friday in a massive sting operation and charged with plotting to blow up targets in southern Ontario with powerful fertilizer bombs. All of the alleged terrorists are Canadian citizens or longtime residents. All are Muslim, and officials say more arrests could be coming soon. In a few minutes, we'll take a closer look at Muslims in Canada and ask how Muslim leaders react to these charges. We'll also talk with terrorism expert Peter Bergen about homegrown Islamic terrorists in North America and Europe. Is Toronto a wake-up call for Americans and Canadians alike? And what role does the Internet play in promoting the ideology of Osama bin Laden around the world? If you have questions about the arrests in Toronto, about the Muslim community there, or about second-generation Islamists terrorists, our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is talk@npr.org. Later in the program, your emails. But first, what we know about the alleged bomb plot in Canada. And we begin with Steve Tustin, city editor of the Toronto Star. And he joins us from his office there. Nice to have you on the program today.
Thank you, Neil.
Did we learn anything new at the bail hearings earlier today?
We did, actually, Neil. We didn't get much out of the courtroom itself. But the lawyers outside the court, when they came out, one of the lawyers for one of the accused, Stephen Vishkas Shan, he's the accused. His Muslim name is Abdul Shakur. His lawyer said that his client was being accused of wanting to decapitate the Prime Minister, Stephen Harper. So that was one of the allegations that came out today. I don't know whether this was expressed in a chat room or verbally to somebody else or whatever, but that's one of the accusations that he had made this threat.
That's a little bit beyond what we'd heard earlier, much of which I have to say was reported in your newspaper.
Yes, well, this information just came out today. This is some of the court information that's coming out, and it's coming out via the lawyers because, of course, the warrants are sealed and so on. So we're getting this information as the lawyers come out of the courtroom.
And there had been questions earlier about what evidence the police may have, even questions about whether the suspects did indeed have the fertilizer that they were intending to use, 3 tons of explosives.
That's correct. And none of that information, none of those questions have been answered today as of yet. There have been allegations, of course, that law enforcement officials did assist in the sale or delivery of this of the fertilizer. So what their role was, some people are saying there might have been some entrapment raising that issue, but none of those questions have been answered yet out of the courtroom today.
And do we know when they might start to be answered?
Hopefully later today, but I think this process is going to go on for a long time. At the last I had checked, 9 of the of the 12 men accused of plotting the attacks had appeared. So we haven't had any word yet. I don't think they'll be getting to whether they're going to get bail or not for a while. I think this is going to drag on for a long time.
Mm-hmm. And the five teenagers, they're underage. They will be, it's a whole separate procedure.
Yes, they are. And they're, of course, we can't name them under our laws up here, under our Youth Criminal Justice Act. But it's interesting. We had a story in today's paper. We had tracked down where 4 of these 5 youths had been going to a prayer room, a prayer center near their high school. And what we had discovered is that they had gone there, started frequenting this prayer room, and then at the same time, their whole sort of lifestyle seemed to change. They became far more orthodox, and their views started to change according to their classmates and so on. And so what the allegations are is that this prayer center was sort of a hotspot for radical views on politics.
And do we know at this point? You mentioned earlier the internet. Some of these statements, which are seem on the face of it very provocative, beheading the Prime Minister, whether that came from an Internet chat room or not, the Internet did play a role in the investigation, apparently.
The Internet played a key role in this investigation, Neil, and I think more is going to come out about that tomorrow on just what a role the Internet played. I mean, I think for a lot of people who have been aware of this for a while, but I think for a lot of people, their eyes are going to be opened about just the activity and what type of activity, particularly among some of these disaffected Muslim youth, is going on the Internet.
We have to remember that a few years ago in Canada, police undertook another counterterrorism operation in and around Toronto known as Project Thread, and if memory serves, that eventually produced nothing.
That's correct, and those ended up being mostly minor immigration offenses, and most of the people were deported. So that's why we have a bit of, you know, skepticism, and we should, of course, as the media, we should have a healthy skepticism. These people are innocent until proven guilty, of course. But that incident certainly raises some questions about the police investigation, and we're looking very closely at that. And these things are, you know, these things are hard to prove, and the defense lawyers today, of course, are arguing very vociferously that they're being denied access to their clients, access to information, and so on. So this is certainly going to drag on for a while, and I think it's going to take a long time before we actually get to see the guts of the police investigation.
Do we know what, if any, international aspects there are to this?
Well, there's been some stories that have been written, not in our paper, about the fact that this may have been connected to a series of other arrests that happened around the same time or on the same day around the world, particularly the one in London, England, where one fellow was shot in the shoulder.
Mm-hmm.
We haven't been able to confirm that, and so far our information seems to be that these aren't connected. But there certainly were, there was help from U.S. investigators, I believe, in this case.
And let's see if we can get some listeners involved in the conversation. Our number, 800-989-8255, and the email address is talk@npr.org. Here's a question from Derek in Ashland, Oregon.
Hey, thanks, Neil.
Sure.
I know you can't get inside the mind of these people, per se, but it strikes me as, why Canada? Canada hasn't invaded anyone, and certainly not overseas and other countries bombing people. I thought, according to President Bush, that's why we were over in Iraq. We were going to fight them over there and not over here. So what gives?
Steve Tustin, of course, Canadian troops are currently serving in Afghanistan, though not Iraq.
Yes, and we have been in Afghanistan for quite a while now. And, of course, we've taken over from the U.S. troops a far more central role in Afghanistan, and as a result, we started to suffer an increased number of casualties in Afghanistan. I think, though, to answer the question, why Canada? Just like the United States, we have a large immigrant population. Just in the greater Toronto area alone, there's 250,000 Muslims, it's quite a significant population here. We're a very multicultural city region. But, of course, with any large group, large diaspora you have, you're going to have disaffected youth, you're going to have disaffected people. And I think from what we've seen so far and what we've, the group that we've looked at here, the suspects we've looked at here, I think, you know, one might draw the conclusion that they're, some of them aren't focused. Certainly their lives don't appear to be focused. But there is no doubt that there is some resentment, I think, too, within the various communities about our role in Afghanistan, not only in the ethnic communities and in the diverse communities, but also within the general population. People are divided about whether we should be there or not. So there's quite a bit. It's quite a strong issue, definitely.
I read, I think, and thank you, by the way, Derek, very much for the phone call.
Thanks.
I did read a quote from Prime Minister Harper a couple of days ago saying we're being targeted because of who we are and what we believe in. And it was interesting. I think one of the leaders of the Muslim community in Ontario said we're being targeted because of who we are and what we believe in.
I think everybody sort of has their own position and they're digging in on that. I mean, since the election and the we have a minority government in place here now, which mm-hmm. is the Conservatives, they've certainly taken a stand on Iraq and on Afghanistan that's far. far more in line with the U.S. stand than the previous Liberal administration did. So I think that's turned the heat up a little bit in some communities. And I think you know, post 9/11, I mean, the Muslim communities here, as elsewhere around the world, particularly felt that they were operating under that shadow and living their lives under that shadow. We have, of course, had other arrests. Your listeners may not know that, but there's been several Canadians who've been arrested abroad or in Syria or whatever, who were accused of being terrorists, who ended up not being terrorists. But on the other hand, we also have a family from here, fairly well known, and their son, their youngest son, is now in Guantanamo, and he is he's the young teenager accused of killing the U.S. soldier early on in Afghanistan. So, you know, we're part of it, and even though we're not in Iraq, all the things that go on there and all the issues resonate quite strongly here.
Some, and I'm afraid we just have a few seconds left with you, but some are drawing an analogy that says this may be closer to Oklahoma City and Tim McVeigh than to London last July.
I think so, but we're going to find out. I think that I think you're right in the sense, Neil, that the shock here is that this is homegrown. If this is legitimate, if this is indeed what they were planning to do, that it's homegrown. And I think people are struggling with the fact. They're saying, you know, why do they want to blow us up? We're all Canadians. Why do you want to blow your neighbor up? And I think that's one question people are struggling with. I think the other one they're struggling with is how do these young men, or how do any group of young men, all of a sudden, you know, transform themselves into radical fundamentalists in the midst of an affluent.
Steve Tustin, I'm afraid we are out of time now, but thanks so much for your time today.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you, Neil.
Steve Tustin, city editor of the Toronto Star, who joined us from his offices there. When we come back, more on this question. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking today about the arrests of 17 men and teens in Canada accused in a plot to target buildings in Ontario with homemade fertilizer bombs. All the men were Canadian citizens or longtime residents, and all are Muslim. Later in the program, we'll talk with terrorism expert Peter Bergen about what this suggests about patterns of terrorism in Europe and America. But first, how news of these arrests affects Muslims in Canada. And of course, you're invited to join the conversation. Our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email is talk@npr.org. Canada is widely seen as one of the most tolerant countries in the world. It actively recruits and welcomes immigrants to its shores, and many are Muslim. In the 1960s, Muslims from South Asia began emigrating there. Today, more than 750,000 Muslims call Canada home. For a closer look at this community, we go now to one of its leaders. Faisal Kuti is vice chair of the Canadian Council on American-Islamic Relations, and he joins us today from Toronto. Good of you to take the time to be with us.
Thank you for having me.
Tell us a bit about the Muslim community in Canada, which countries they come from, what kind of jobs they have.
The Muslim community in Canada is a very diverse, multicultural community representing, the entire gamut internationally. The bulk of them, as you indicated in your intro, emigrated, in the early 60s, 70s from South Asia. Since then, you know, people from Afghanistan came as refugees, Somalia more recently, and then Eastern Europe. It's a very well-educated community. It has higher education than the average population, but unfortunately a little bit lower or double the unemployment rate. But in terms of integration, I mean, we're on the way there. As you know, we've struggled through our initial struggles that every immigrant community goes through, and then now we're getting into the more establishment phase of getting integrated fully more with society.
In terms of immigration, I've heard Canada more closely compared to the United States rather than to countries in Europe, which are less accustomed to immigrants.
That's right. I mean, we welcome hundreds of thousands of people every year, and you know, for a Muslim community, Muslim countries represent a huge percentage of that as well.
And how are Muslims reacting to the news of these arrests?
Shock and disbelief. I mean, it's, you know, if the allegations are true, then, you know, it points to a very serious issue that the community itself has to deal with. You know, and I think it's, I mean, the initial reaction is just shock. And, you know, we have a very a history of strained relations between law enforcement or security agencies and the Muslim community since 9/11. But because of the shock and you know, the threat, the alleged threat to Canada, all of the organizations, even the ones that were the most critical, initially issued statements saying, you know, we applaud the intelligence agencies for averting this disaster and calling on Muslims to fully cooperate with the authorities. And that's the position we've taken. And basically what we're saying is, of course, these individuals are innocent until proven guilty, and they should be presumed innocent, and we're calling for an open, transparent process where the rule of law is followed. Then the communities can continue with that confidence level.
And again, we were talking just a moment ago with Steve Tustin of the Toronto Star and recalling a project, a thread, an investigation of Muslims that did not turn up serious crimes.
That's right. This is part of the baggage that Muslims have, had issues with the security agencies. I mean, Project Thread, where 24 individuals were arrested, and initially was a big terrorist case, supposedly, but at the end of the day, none of them were convicted of any terrorist charges. In fact, all of them were deported on very minor immigration infractions. And, you know, in addition to that, there's been instances where a Canadian citizen was deported, using the extraordinary rendition. The United States had deported the Canadian citizen Mahar Arar, and it's going through a public hearing right now. And, you know, Canada's role is being questioned in that. You know, how do we hand over a Canadian citizen and allow for him to be deported to be tortured for information? So these kind of fears were there. And then we also had a lot of instances where people were claiming to be harassed and pursued by intelligence agents. Racial profiling is alleged. And, so because of that, there was a chill factor growing in the community.
Mm-hmm.
And so, what we've done now is ask the community to put the trust back in the security agencies and say, listen, we're going to leave it to them now to prove that they're going to do this by allowing the judicial process to fully go through. All right? And the new anti-terrorism laws that were enacted right after 9/11, similar to your Patriot Act, allows for proceedings to be conducted in closed hearings, and also allows for the use of secret evidence. And we're hoping that the government does not resort to that, because, again, that creates fear for us. Because when you use, when you have closed hearings and secret proceedings, it makes it easy to racially profile. It makes it easy to criminalize dissent. And we're hoping that what they were alleged to have done is a criminal act, and they should be prosecuted criminally. And if they're guilty, the full punishment should be meted out to them, but using the criminal process and the rule of law.
All right, let's get another caller in on the conversation. Ahmad joins us. Ahmad calling from Minneapolis.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I am one of the Muslims here in the United States, which I was not born in this country, but I immigrated about 17 years ago, and I consider the United States my country. This is where I live. This is my home. And when I hear things like what happened in Canada, very unfortunate, and it is devastating for the Muslims in America, North America, of course, and the U.S. and Canada, because what happens is that Muslims get really a lot of prejudice and discrimination against them, because the majority of people cannot distinguish between the terrorists and the peace-loving Muslims. And, of course, I'm sure most of your listeners know that Islam condemns killing of innocent people and terrorism. And to call these people Islamic terrorists or Islamist terrorists or Islamic fundamentalists, that is a completely bad phrase to use for them, because they are breaking the laws of Islam to commit these acts. And because we know when Eric Rudolph, the abortion clinic bomber, was bombing the abortion clinics and the Atlanta Olympics and so on, even though he was using Christianity as a reason behind what he was doing, he was not called a Christianist terrorist or Christian fundamentalist. Or when Jewish Defense League, JDL, when they were caught and they were labeled a terrorist group, they were not called a Jewish terrorist group. But when a Muslim does, they're automatically called an Islamist terrorist or Islamic fundamentalist or so on, which really puts a burden on the rest of us, and about 10 million Muslims in North America, that we have to prove that we are not terrorists.
Just to say that some people did indeed identify the Atlanta bomber as a Christian fundamentalist or a Christian identity fundamentalist, and indeed the JDL, the first word is Jewish. But anyway, Faisal Kuti, I wonder if we get your response to that.
I mean, the way I like to look at this is, you know, if these individuals, and again, the presumption of innocence is there, but if these individuals have done, you know, what they're alleged to have done, then they're criminals. Okay, they're criminals, just like, you know, the immediately afterwards, I mean, at least three mosques in Canada were targeted by vandals. I mean, we don't hold the mainstream, you know, society responsible for that. There's criminal elements from within the mainstream who did this, and most Canadians would not even think of doing something like that in retaliation for the actions of a criminal band within our community. So I think we have to realize that every society, every community has its wackos and fringe elements, and that's how they have to be treated. And you know, you will not find any support for you know what they allegedly to have done and the views that they allegedly have espoused in the mainstream, in the majority of Muslims who live in Canada.
Okay, Ahmad, thanks very much for the call. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
And has there been any obviously innocent till proven guilty? Has there been? This group allegedly focused around one particular mosque in a suburb of Toronto. Are there mosques that preach after the first bomb plot against the World Trade Center? Obviously, that was centered in a mosque in Brooklyn. Are there similar kinds of mosques in Canada where the sort of hotbeds of preaching these kinds of actions?
Even the mosques that these individuals are. At least I believe they said six people, six of these individuals were supposed to have frequented.
Mm-hmm.
Even that, the mosque is distancing itself from these statements, from these comments. And in fact, the individual, when he was making that, one of the ringleaders, the over 40 individual who's a charge here, he's supposed to, I guess, the media is projecting him as the leader for now.
Mm-hmm.
He is supposed to have been the caretaker at that mosque. And from time to time, you know, he has led prayers there or delivered sermons. Not the official sermon, but, you know, he's spoken there. So, I mean, you know, the official mosque position is not supportive of it. And because what happens in a mosque is very different from a church or a synagogue. In a church or a synagogue, you have a leadership, you have membership. It's very controlled. In a mosque, what happens is anybody can walk into any mosque, anybody can speak in any mosque, you know, you can take a corner. Now, of course, people are beginning to challenge that. As a lawyer, I see mosques coming to me now after this event, and even after the 9/11 bombing, people coming to me, they're putting in place policies now. Who can speak? Who can post materials? And in fact, yesterday I had at least two mosques come into my office. They want written policies. They want me to help draft written policies on who can speak, you know, how to control these things. Because it's funny, you know, people think of Islam as non-democratic, but when you go to a mosque, it's the most democratic because anybody can walk in there, anybody can interpret the Quran, anybody can say they're the leader and start talking. And in this case here, it's kind of like an Achilles heel or a tendon here where it's hindering, you know, it's making it difficult because nobody can say, I have the interpretation, because everybody makes the interpretation, everybody can lead a prayer, for instance. If I walk into the mosque, people may push me to lead the prayer. I am not a cleric, and I don't even have training in thorough training in Islam. But if I'm there, 10 people may be in the mosque at that particular time for that prayer, they may say, oh, Faisal, you lead. You know what I'm saying? So
yes.
That may have happened in the situation. So, but to blame the mosque for it, I I've seen that the mosque has distanced itself from this thing. So we really can't say that a particular mosque is involved in this or supportive of this.
Faisal Kuti, thank you very much. Appreciate your time today.
Thank you very much.
Faisal Kuti is vice chair of the Canadian Council on American Islamic Relations, and he joined us from Toronto. If the allegations prove to be true, then North America will join Europe in dealing with an ugly new reality, homegrown Islamist terrorism. Believers in Osama bin Laden's violent ideology no longer need to attend training camps in the Middle East. Instead, the Internet has become a virtual training center offering inspiration worldwide. We go now to terrorism expert Peter Bergen, the author most recently of The Osama Bin Laden I Know, a senior fellow at the New America Foundation. He's with us today from Zurich in Switzerland, where he's on a working vacation. And Peter, I'm glad you decided to help us and work a little bit more today.
Thank you, Neil.
What could the arrests in Canada signal? Does this look like a case of what you call self-starter terrorism?
Well, you know, I think in Canada and the United States, we felt somewhat insulated from the sort of things we've seen in Madrid and London and in the Netherlands, where we've seen significant acts of terrorism in the last 3 years, because I think that we felt, hey, we're societies built on immigration, we're used to dealing with Muslim immigrants, they're integrating well, and I think that story is largely true. But I must say, A, if indeed the allegations against the group in Canada are correct, that is troubling, and B, we've seen some other cases, both in Canada and the United States, of homegrown, self-starting, citizens of the United States or Canada engaging in terrorist or jihadist activities in the last year or so. This is not the only case, and I'll give you three examples. One, in Torrance, California, a case that will go to trial in October of this year, the allegation is that four American citizens or residents who got radicalized in prison with a sort of radical Islamic Islamist ideology planned to attack synagogues and U.S. military bases in Southern California. A second example, in Toledo, Ohio, the allegation is was made a few weeks ago, or perhaps a couple of months ago, a group again of American citizens and residents, three of them, were training to go and fight in Iraq. And in fact, the head of the Canadian Secret Security Intelligence Service, Jim Judd, has said publicly in Canada that Canadians are showing up to fight in Iraq. So these have been sort of canaries in the mine, and I'm not saying that there is a huge trend here, but clearly the comforting notion that there wouldn't be homegrown, domestic, second-generation Muslim Americans or Muslim Canadians engaging in terrorism, I think we really have to call into question now.
Peter Bergen, we're talking about allegations in Canada of a massive bomb plot. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And Peter, as you look at these cases, even the somewhat lurid allegations coming out today, the lawyer for one of the accused saying the charges included plans to behead the Prime Minister of Canada or take over the CBC or charge Parliament, but no one has said there are links to Al-Qaeda.
Yeah, and I mean, that's sort of a good news, bad news story, because the bad news is that if indeed the allegations are true, this is people who got radicalized on the Internet. You may have got radicalized by watching, pictures on CNN or Al Jazeera or whatever of what's happening in Iraq. The good news is that Al-Qaeda, the organization, was able to conduct the 9/11 attacks. You need an organization to really do something big. And these guys, even if the most lurid allegations are true, were basically, making some extremely dumb statements about attacking the Prime Minister of Canada and ordering, ammonium nitrate in quantities that you wouldn't associate with gardening. But, they never got anywhere. And in fact, I was in London over the weekend, where, of course, there's been another case, which is similar, I think, in some ways, where the allegation is that a couple of London residents were planning a chemical weapons attack. There was a massive operation in London to arrest these guys. One of them was shot in circumstances that remain murky during the operation. But as more of this comes out, it seems that these guys, it's not really clear what they were doing. They certainly had no links to Al-Qaeda. And these homegrown terrorists, yes, they can do some damage, but unless they've actually gone to Pakistan and learned how to really make bombs, I think that they will be, at worst they can be, quite difficult. But I think generally speaking, they'll be a nuisance. A good example of where they were quite, they managed to succeed quite successfully, was what happened in Madrid in 2004, where a group of people who never contacted Al-Qaeda, the classic organization, were just local militants, killed 191 people on their way to work in Madrid. But that is sort of exceptional. I think the self-starting groups have tended to be kind of less competent. They're harder for law enforcement to detect, because they often haven't been to Afghanistan or Pakistan or those kinds of markers that law enforcement would be looking for. But also, unless you've actually gone to a training camp in Afghanistan, learning these things on the Internet is really not the same thing.
Peter, stay with us. We're going to take more questions about this after a break. If you'd like to join the conversation, our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. You can also send us email. The address is talk@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. We'll be back after the break. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. We'll be right back. In a few minutes, your emails on Haditha, Gen Y, and city slogans. But first, we continue talking about the alleged terror plot in Canada. Our guest is Peter Bergen, an expert on terrorism, a fellow at the New America Foundation here in Washington, D.C., and the author most recently of the Osama bin Laden I Know. He's with us on the phone from Zurich. If you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email is talk@npr.org. And let's get a listener in the conversation. Jeff calling from Kitchener in Ontario.
Right. You'd probably get more calls from Canada if your 800 number was reachable from Canada.
Okay. We'll look into that, Jeff. But go ahead.
All right. So my point is there's an elephant in the room here in the coverage in Canada, and everybody seems to be ignoring the elephant, and the elephant is religion. And the head of Canada's of the Toronto Police Force is quoted in my morning paper here in Canada as saying, these folks were motivated by an ideology based on politics, hatred, and terrorism, and not on faith. Well, this just seems preposterous. If you try to divorce the alleged actions of these people from their faith, then you completely miss the context to understand why they're doing it. And they're doing it based on faith, in part.
On their interpretation of a faith,
Absolutely. Perhaps.
Peter. Yep.
Absolutely. I mean, there are passages in the Quran that say, you know, what you're supposed to do is kill the unbelievers, slay them.
But as Faisal Kuti was telling us earlier,
191. I mean, how can you not? How can you? You know, you have to understand that this is a part of the reason behind this kind of terrorism.
But as Faisal Kuti was telling us earlier, and he certainly knows more about Islam than I do, there are other passages that say, you know, there's nothing that justifies the murder of the innocent. Anyway, Peter Bergen, you probably know more about Islam than I do, too.
Well, let me pick up on the call from Kitchener and also from an earlier call who made the point that when Eric Rudolph was arrested, that there wasn't much claims that he was a Christian fundamentalist terrorist, and you, Neil, sort of corrected him, I think, correctly, saying that, you know, that certainly that Eric Rudolph said he was a Christian identity believer, which is a very extreme form of sort of racialist Christianity, and certainly the Jewish Defense League, the terrorist group in Israel, sees itself as a Jewish organization. I don't think, you know, I there are arguments on both sides of this. The Quran is full of injunctions against killing civilians. And in fact, when bin Laden was asked directly by an Al Jazeera interview, how do you justify 9/11, he didn't resort to language from the Quran or the Hadith, the sayings of the Prophet Muhammad. He said, hey, American taxpayers pay for American foreign policy, and that's why they died on 9/11. Now, last time I checked, there's nothing about American foreign policies in the Quran. So even bin Laden finds it hard to justify this from a Quranic perspective. That being said, the Quran is also has a number of justifications for war, including the so-called sword verses, which are the offensive verses justifying an offensive war. And those verses which are in the Quran, which is, after all, the word of God, quite literally, if you believe it, if you are a Muslim, you believe the Quran is literally the word of God. One of the verses says that when the sacred months are passed, attack the infidels, you know, in an unprovoked manner. I'm paraphrasing. So, but why would a group of, let's say the allegation is true about these guys in Canada, you know, surely there are other reasons than, their reading of, you know, particularly provocative passages reinterpreted by radical clerics in the Quran. You know, one of the problems that we always have is what are the root causes of all this? And I mean, to be honest with you, no one can really answer that. It you know, there are so many factors that go into this. The group in Canada, you know, some of them are college educated, some are unemployed. And if you look at the kind of profile of so many of these terrorists, in the past, they have tended to be people who are educated, obviously male. You know, they may have problems in their life. Mohammed Atta, the lead hijacker, was somebody who I think was a rather problematic personality. On the other hand, the other pilot, Ziad Jarrah, in the 9/11 attacks, you know, had a girlfriend. He had a close relationship with his family. And so it's extremely hard to disentangle all this. Clearly, they're doing it in the name of a very twisted version of Islam. I'm not of the view, as some have, some academics like Karen Armstrong and John Esposito have sort of said, Islam's got nothing to do with it. I think that's taking it way too far. That would be saying, like, you know, the Catholic faith had nothing to do with the Irish Republican Army. Certainly, those in the Irish Republican Army in Ireland saw their Catholic faith in very much in contradistinction to the Protestants that were supposedly oppressing them in Northern Ireland. So if you ask the people engaged in these activities, I'm not talking about the Canadians now, but if you ask Bin Laden what he's doing, he would say this is all in defense of Islam. And surely there is some part of that that must be true.
Jeff, thanks.
Yeah, it's not agnostics that are making bombs. I just want to point out.
No, but let me pick up on that, because the people who've actually done the most damage in the world, in my view, are the people who've abolished religion completely. And I'll give you four pretty good examples.
Agnostics aren't abolishing religion completely. Agnostics just profess not to know whether or not there's a God.
Well, I misspoke, but I misspoke, but let me finish. Stalin, Hitler, Mao, and Pol Pot, one of the first things they all did was abolish the church and basically, you know, produce essentially ideologies that say religion is wrong. So I think the most dangerous people are people who actually take God out of the equation. Usually, if you have God somewhere in the equation, that is actually a break on actually some of the worst aspects of the human characteristics and personality.
All right. As we look at this, your piece in the paper, the Canadian paper, the other day suggested that if these allegations are true, and you mentioned these other examples of charges that have been brought up, cases that are pending, again, if they're proven, it does indicate that we may be entering a new phase.
Yeah, I mean, it would be extremely disturbing if indeed suddenly in North America, both in Canada and the United States, that we see that this sort of Al-Qaeda virus is actually catching on. Because, I mean, I have repeatedly said in the past 5 years in the United States that, you know, really one of the great unsung stories, I think, is the way the American Muslim community has basically rejected the Al-Qaeda ideology completely. But were it the case that suddenly the case I mentioned in Torrance, California, the case in Toledo, Ohio, there's another case in Lodi, California, and now this case in Canada. You know, we're not talking about large numbers of people, but these kinds of acts don't require large numbers of people. That we would be in a very different, I think, situation, both in the United States and Canada, if this trend continued, and suddenly we were more in a European situation, the sorts of things that we're seeing in London and Spain and Madrid. And in the Netherlands, I think this would be quite disturbing.
Let's talk now with Samina. Samina calling from Santa Clara in California.
Hi. My name is Samina again, and I'm an American Muslim, born and raised in San Diego. And I completely disagree with the point made that you cannot divorce the religion from, you know, the acts of terror, you know, that these people are trying or have perpetrated. In reality, you know, Islam does not condone an aggressive war. It says clearly in the Quran that God does not love the aggressors. And, you know, if there is cause for a battle, that if they come to you with peace, then you come to them with peace. So it continually says that, you know, like if you kill one innocent person, you know, it's as though you've killed all of humanity. And if you saved one innocent person, it is if you have saved all of humanity. So all of these passages just completely disprove the fact that, you know, the religion is somehow, you know, inciting, you know, these acts. In reality, I think the other speaker was saying that it is more of a socioeconomic issue. It's more of a bastardization of the religion, unfortunately, by even Muslims themselves. I'm not going to, you know, say that there are no Muslims that are, you know, saying wrong things about Islam. But you can't say that it's the religion itself. It's the way that some people are teaching it. But the vast majority of Muslims have, you know, condemned terrorism. You know, I actually work for the Council on American Islamic Relations, and consistently, you know, whenever there's a, you know, a terrorist attack or whenever something, whether it's been conducted by Muslims or, you know, or people of other faiths, we've continually condemned it. And many other organizations, such as the Muslim American Society, ISNA, the Islamic Society of North America, have continually denounced terrorism. But unfortunately, that doesn't get much play on the news at all. You know, we have many events, you know, that are held to condemn terrorism, and, you know, of course that never gets coverage. And then you hear people saying, why does the Muslim community, why do they not condemn terrorism? But, you know, it's just because people aren't listening.
Yeah. Thanks very much for that. Peter, I think to some degree, again, while some could say Osama bin Laden would say this is not an aggressive war, but a defensive war, and they have brought war to us.
Well, I mean, I agree with everything the caller just said, but I'd make two points. And I think there is a very healthy thing going on in the Muslim world right now. I think she pointed out that there was this kind of conventional wisdom that Muslim clerics aren't condemning these activities, and I think that's basically proved wrong by recent events in Indonesia after the second Bali attack in November of 2005 that killed mostly Indonesians. There's been really a popular revulsion and Indonesian clerics sort of standing up against the Al-Qaeda affiliate there. We saw the same thing happen in Jordan with the attacks on the three American-owned hotels. We've also seen in Saudi Arabia significant clerics condemning terrorism after it, you know, bombs started going off in their own backyard. So I think this is very important. But I would, on the other hand, point out, you mentioned earlier on the program, Neil, about the question of Haditha and the alleged massacre mm-hmm. that happened there. Let's assume that's true. Why is it that we're hearing condemnation of the Haditha massacre from around the Muslim world, yet we never hear any condemnation of Zakawi by name, who is doing a Haditha every single day in Iraq? It's an outrageous, I mean, the Haditha thing is outrageous in itself, but the silence on the Zakawi front, I think, is rather telling.
Samina, thank
you. I'm sorry, I just have one comment to say.
And if you make it very quick, please.
Yeah, very quick. In Jordan, when there was a bombing in Amman, right after that, there were hundreds of thousands of people who were demonstrating in the streets, condemning Al-Qaeda, condemning, the people who are, perpetuating this war in Iraq. And
in the Sinai as well, after bombings there. And those did get covered, Samina. So anyway, but I'm afraid we're out of time, and I have to thank you very much for the call. Samina calling us from Santa Clara. Peter Bergen, we'll let you get back to your vacation. We appreciate it.
Thank you. Bye.
Peter Bergen, author most recently of the Osama bin Laden, I know, the fellow at the New America Foundation, joining us by phone today from Zurich. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.